away from the tower. In other words, the top of the dipole with an insulator is mechanically supported by the top of the tower, and the rest of the dipole, maybe it's longer than the tower is high, and you're sloping it off to one side. And so the exact angle that you slope it is not critical. If you really made the tower the exact same altitude as the dipole that's right alongside of it, and if the bottom of the radio tower was thoroughly insulated at the base, you could now make a two-element Yagi out of that. Ordinarily, if the tower is a little bit off of resonance, a little bit too long or a little bit too short, and the bottom of it is grounded, your mind is going to tell you that, boy, that's a great big blockage in that area. It is not. If it's a non-resonant structure, it is 98% transparent, opposite of common sense. A full half-wave dipole on 80 meters has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. And I'm not kidding. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked at a half-wave dipole that's resonating and operating, let me drop, you would see, you're looking at this dipole at 80 meters, you would see a great big oval in space, which is more than 132 feet on the long dimension, probably more than 50 or 60 feet on the short dimension. This big oval in space would be a black area where all of the 80-meter antenna, all of the 80-meter signal coming from space is sucked up by that black hole, appears on that wire, goes down the transmission line, and moves the S-meter of the receiver. The real effective capture area of a 80-meter dipole is that big. 0.13 lambda squared is the area of every half-wave dipole you've ever used. Once you realize that, you realize that your horizontal dipole at the exact same altitude as the Con Ed wires across the street, you think it's going to give you a blockage because that's the favorite DX direction you want to work in. As long as those wires are non-resonant, they are so small in shadow area compared to the real area of the antenna, it's not there. You'd be amazed how many people think that they're stopped by things like that, and they're not. You'd be amazed how many times a guy will operate with a VHF or a UHF antenna on the side of the tower. He thinks he's going to get a great big blockage in the direction of the tower, and in many cases that blockage is an extremely minor one. That RF energy folds around that tower like water pouring into the town, going around the flagpole, if you know what I mean. It's a very transparent structure in many cases, very different than common sense. Okay, we've come up to the one-hour point. We really should go over to Mel's mailbag right now, and then we'll go back to answering questions and so on, and also if Paul's ready with his space report. K2KEY, what kind of burning questions have you had this week, Mel? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, I have one of these questions that's been sitting here for a while. I just, why it just popped into my mind, and I dug it up, and I never said to myself, should I bring this up? Shouldn't I bring it up? Is it important or anything? But yeah, being that we're talking about radios, I'll just do a real quickie on this one. The FCC used to require all AM broadcast stations to lay down a number of radios. Am I correct that it was 120 radios? Was that a law? Is it still a law, Dick? Over.
I don't think it's a law. I think it was a strong recommendation. If, as a broadcast station, you lay down a large number of radios, like 120 of them, you're now forcing all of the earth around that broadcast antenna to act like a almost complete sheet of metal. Therefore, the antenna is going to be high efficiency. Therefore, the broadcast station is really going to be doing the performance. In other words, when the FCC gives you a frequency allocation for your broadcast station in your particular town, in your particular portion of the state, they have set aside that amount of real estate, that many square miles. They hope there'll be a strong enough signal that you really can serve that public. To serve that public, they have to be getting a strong enough signal that their receiver in their automobile or on their countertop in their kitchen has to give them enough performance that they hear the signal, they hear the advertisement, and the station license is really being used. So it's a strong recommendation to ensure that if you're licensed for a 1,000-watt station, that you're really going to have the coverage area and the signal strength to keep your customers happy in that area as a 1,000-watt station. Other than that, you're either going to be forced to go to a higher power in order to get the coverage, and it's inefficient, or you're not going to be properly serving that number of square miles of public. So I don't know if it was a law. I'm sure it was at least a strong recommendation for that motivation, as I see it, Mel. That's my impression. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment, towards you.
Comment?
A person with comment, start off with your call letters and your name. First, go ahead.
K2MIT, Jeffrey. There was a tower company based in New Jersey, and its name is going to escape me, but they built those beautiful towers. There's still one in Queens. They were very skinny at the bottom, and they were fat in the middle, and they were very skinny at the top, and then they were attached to the ground through guy wires in the middle and the top. If anyone remembers the name of the tower company when I'm done, let me know. But I read an interview with the station manager of one of those towers out in Iowa, and he said that they did have 120 radials, and that it was a suggestion by the FCC, and they also had to put up a standoff, a vertical boom, 60 feet away, because their signal pattern was skipping over a local area. So they have a picture of this beautiful tower with this 60-foot long boom hung off the side of it. I didn't quite understand the electronics theory of that, but if anyone knows the name of the tower company, they're beautiful towers, but he did state that the FCC recommended the 120 radios, and they were a clear channel station.
Quebec, Golf Sulu.
Bill recognized, and Bill works in the broadcast industry, so I'm looking forward to his results, his answer on this one. And Jeff, yeah, that tower is a beautiful mechanical engineering design that definitely emphasizes what's called the zero-moment base. Let me explain that. I can stand up on top of my 100 feet of tower, where I'm standing 10 feet above a guy wire, and I push my body in and out toward the tower, and I look down the tower. What do I see? I see the tower snaking back and forth in between the guy wires. I'm only bending the upper section, but the rest of the tower snakes back and forth. It literally makes a multiple S-curves all the way down to the ground, including the base. So every real tower, when the wind blows and the tower sways back and forth, the base is being twisted left and right, you know, north and south, east and west. The base is being twisted. And if you got the base in a solid chunk of concrete, which sounds like a good common sense way to do it, you're giving ridiculous bending moments to that steel. You're eventually going to get steel fatigue failure. Therefore, let me drop. Therefore, the better engineered towers do the illogical thing. They've got this great big ball bearing at the bottom, where the bottom of the tower can pivot back and forth without bending the steel. And the next level above that is to make the tower fat in the middle and skinny on the top and skinny on the bottom. And now you're really using the zero-moment base characteristic. As the tower wants to bend in any way it wants to on a windy day, you're not giving extra flexure, you're giving extra deflection and fatigue, metal failure to the tower, particularly near the base. So that's the mechanical engineering behind that funny looking tower. And by the way, it's also high end performance, because the maximum current point in some cases is near the middle of the tower, where you've got the maximum mass of tower. So it could be a very efficient design. That's part of what's going on, and so you remember it as a recommendation. Bill, I bet you with all the friends you've got in the broadcast industry, you know more about whether or not it is a hard and fast rule or a recommendation. Mr. QGZ, K2RIW on TechNet, you got it, Bill.
Hey, good evening, W2QGZ. I believe the tower is a Blau Knox, is the manufacturer. And I wasn't aware there were any of those left in this neck of the woods anymore. So if they're still all around, that'd be pretty cool. I'd be interested in where it is. You know, the counterpoise really is a function of when you go out and look at your, when you do a proof of performance and do your radiation density at whatever distance, at whatever points you decide you're going to monitor to determine, in the case of an Omni, that you're really Omni and that you have the proper signal in all directions. So your performance is going to depend on your ability to meet your station parameters that are defined for you is going to depend on how you do the counterpoise. And I have worked on a couple of colos where we had to decouple AM from, you know, to physically mount some other antennas on the tower and then decouple these things either through filters or by band the skirt, where the actual ground was a rectangular screen as opposed to radials, and it covered the same area pretty much, but it was just a rectangular, in some cases from the old days, believe it or not, copper screen with maybe 3-4 inch by 3-4 inch squares that was just laid down under the property.
35, Bill, and thank you for that info. So Blau Knox, yes. And the last I remember reading the particular website, there was a Blau Knox antenna still in existence a few years ago somewhere in the open fields of New Jersey. A very high power broadcast station in the past was located there with that kind of an antenna. When it comes to that extra element that you're describing, Jeff, the real pattern you get when you make field measurements around a broadcast tower, you've got to ensure to the FCC by real measurements that the north, northeast, east, east, southeast, southeast, at all of the compass directions, you have the right number of volts per meter, watts per square meter, whatever units you want to use. Real power flux density in each of those directions has to be assured. That proves to the FCC you're really serving that community that they have set aside for you for that particular broadcast license. And there's a number of variables that could give you less coverage in one particular direction. It could be because of a local hill, local conductivity of the soil, a whole bunch of industrial buildings nearby, whatever. There's a bunch of reasons why in some particular direction your signal could be not what you expect it to be. Therefore, by adding another element to be using the Yagi technique, so to speak, let me drop. You can increase the signal strength in that direction that normally doesn't have the proper coverage. So it's a way of correcting your pattern measurement characteristics because of local terrain and terrestrial and domestic buildings and so on. Another possible reason is that you're a clear channel or a nearly clear channel, but there's an adjacent community 100 miles away where you're going to create co-channel interference, and the FCC wants you to give them a slight notch in that direction. That exact same element that you described, that other parasitic element off to one side of the tower, fed with a different phase, could create a notch in the pattern in that direction to fulfill the requirement not to create a squealing co-channel interference to the people that are in that direction, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot of reasons why multiple towers are put up or multiple a tower with other structures nearby to control the pattern. Over to you for any further questions on this one, Jeff. That's my understanding. K2MIT for any of the comments. K2RIW. K2RQ. RQ recognized. We'll get to you in a minute. You got it, Jeff.
Thanks. Yeah, it was Blau Knox. Excuse me. The last station was WABO in New York, New York, but I was looking it up. It was taken down and replaced. It was 434 feet, and it was a dual. There were two of them side by side. You'd have to go up to Manchester, New Hampshire to see the closest one, and I do understand what you're talking about the parasitic element off on the side. So thank you very much, and thanks for reminding me the other station, what the name was. It was bothering me what the name of that manufacturer was. Quite beautiful antennas. You know, I really think they're just beautiful. K2MIT, back to them.
Very fine, Jeff. All right, we're going to pick up Lou next, N2RQ, who's the man in charge of education in this particular club. So educate us, Lou. I'm having some fun with you. N2RQ, K2RIW.
I'm used to you having fun with me. I have a friend who likes to pull my beard, the same reason. I just thought maybe I would try to summarize something. You've gone very far afield on this general topic, but I think it started with Dave's question about the radials on his vertical. And I think it might be summarized to say that when you don't have the ground plane completely symmetrical, or even if the ground is not symmetrically conductive, that it would affect the radiation pattern, so that the, instead of being totally omnidirectional, the antenna might be directional. Is that correct, Dick? And to RQ, back to you.
Yes, it's definitely true, Lou, but now there's a degree here. By the way, Dave asked a question about radials, but it was really Mel's question we're answering right now, a slightly different radial question. If I start eliminating ground plane radials on the east side of my tower, common sense would lead me to believe that the signal going to the east is going to go to zero. Doesn't do that at all. Yes, it's going to fall down a little bit, and nowhere near as fast as you think. So, you lose a little bit of performance. So, I'm just telling people in general, if the physical layout of where your wife's garden is and where the patio is on the back of your house and so on, you can't lay a full set of ground plane radials in that direction. Ordinarily, you'd lose an awful lot of sleep over it. I'm saying don't lose sleep. Go and do it the best you can, and the difference in performance in many cases is going to be pretty small, is my prediction. But I haven't actually done that exact experiment. When somebody really does, I want them to come back and tell us how well it worked. I know we got pretty far off of your original question, Mel, but back to you. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, just bringing it up. I just was wondering, if they were putting down radials, how did they do it around the Empire State Building, Dick?
The Empire State Building, in order to have a good foundation, I'm guessing they went down, I'm going to pick a number, 3, 4, 5, 6 floors to really have good footing down to the bedrock of Manhattan in order for that building to really hold itself up well. That automatically is giving them the majority of their grounding. It is my best guess. There are no real ground plane radials going out parallel to the ground from the Empire State Building. That just their footing down to bedrock is giving them extremely good grounding as far as lightning is concerned. Talk to anybody who's been in the Empire State Building during a lightning strike. They don't even know that it happens. The guys running the broadcast transmitters up at the 89th floor, yeah, occasionally they're going to see something funny happen with the transmitter because the signal is crawling down the antenna on the peak of the tower coming out of the top of the building, and that burst of electromagnetic pulse goes down the transmission line, and it might give you some arcing effects or whatever in the transmitter. In fact, Bill, you've worked at the Empire State Building on a couple of occasions. And I bet you've been there during a lightning storm, and you've talked to the guys running those transmitters. What kind of grief have those transmitters suffered due to lightning strikes at the Empire State Building? If you're available there, Bill, tell us about this. WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, no first-hand knowledge of anybody who really had an issue with lightning there. I maintained a handful of stuff up there that was involved in the maintenance of some stuff that generally survived. I never really had too much of an issue with it. You know, it's a great big building, and if you're, unless you're mounted on the tippy top, most of the uncomfortable junk is diverted away from you. And, I was up there once, above, inside the tower, above the outdoor observation deck when the platform outside that we had some gear on was struck by lightning. And that was sort of interesting. I had noticed it's a subway grate sort of material, you know, rectangular little boxes you can stand on. And some of that stuff was, the pieces that were just laying in the frame up there were arcing to each other and stuff. And that kind of gave us the idea that it's probably time to beat feet, which we did. But that actually, I don't know where the lightning actually struck the building when that occurred, because there's still another couple hundred feet of tower and antenna above us at that point, but it was pretty spectacular.
My goodness, does that sound like an exciting time, Bill? And you might have to change your clothing after a situation like that one. The good news about the Empire State Building is if you had X-ray vision like Superman and you looked at that building, it's a great big set of steel monkey bars with a bunch of siding around it and a bunch of floors and walls inside. So you're inside of a Faraday shield where those individual girders and beams are all welded together and riveted together and so on. So you're inside of a beautiful Faraday cage inside that building. My guess is you could be at the 102nd floor observation deck inside the building during lightning strikes, and you would experience very little of the effects. It's all going around you. By the same token, if you're inside of a metallic automobile during a lightning strike, almost nobody has ever experienced any grief from that. There are people who will tell you don't touch any of the metal inside the car. I think that's overly conservative. As long as the car, you know, normal bonding of the fender to the rest of the body and the roof to the rest of the body and so on, as long as there's normal bonding, I think you could be touching the metallic objects on the inside of the car. And I think with a lightning strike or whatever, you'd be fairly safe. That's my belief until somebody gives me some further evidence of that. I'm going to continue with that particular belief. So back to you, Mel. I think there are no ground plane radials, your original question, on the Empire State Building, because at the time they were erecting that building, I don't think they owned the adjacent pieces of property. If you really wanted to do a serious job, and maybe you and I could dream about putting ground plane radials for two city blocks in all directions, and you'd have a hell of a time getting permission to do that. K2KEY, and I don't think you need it, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Mel.
Okay, just one last question, Dick, and then we'll go on. Did King Kong get an RF burn while he's hanging on the antenna?
Well, King Kong happens to be on the repeater tonight. If Bill wants to give us a little bit of a description, there was a time when he was out east on Long Island, on the side of a tower, not near the top, strapped in with a safety belt, when the tower was struck with lightning. He's on the outside of this structure, and the current flowing down the structure made a very strong current impulse, a very strong magnetic field, and if I understand correctly, it did make Bill's arms and legs move outward from the tower, and he hung from the belt, and I'm awful glad that he was attached. Am I misrepresenting what took place during that particular incident, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment about King Kong.
Yeah, Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
Pretty much that's my recollection. Again, as we kind of talked about the other day, my memory of that is a little on the fuzzy side. But, that's pretty much my recollection, where, it was kind of a, not necessarily expecting a lightning storm. Saw some junk on the, kind of on the horizon, and started descending. And that was before the ability to have a computer in my truck with, Doppler radar up and everything. So depending on, AM radio weather pretty much, or weather alerts. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Now, while I was reviewing that incident with Bill, and he realizes that the total memory of the incident is fuzzy, and I think there's a definite explanation for that. If you watch one of the latest Nova series on PBS television, as How Does the Mind Work, they've been doing a series of experiments where you literally do something internal to your head, which is the equivalent of writing the information to a hard disk drive, so to speak. There's a section of the memory, a section of the brain, which really is in charge of a major portion of memory. And if at the time a particular incident is occurring, they were exciting the person's head from the outside with pulses of magnetic field. They were putting this coil near the person's head, near the volunteer's head, and they were giving him pulses of current and proving that they could make his finger twitch, they could make his toe twitch, they could make his eye twitch, and they could also affect the way he memorizes material that was happening at that time. At the instant you're laying down the material, if a simultaneous magnetic field occurs in the right portion of the head, a good portion of that memory does not take place. Therefore, I am speculating that Bill may have been doing that experiment because a lot of current is flowing down that tower near him at the time of the incident. Therefore, he has a fuzzier memory. That is my speculation. And we'll eventually maybe get some further confirmation of that in the future. Jeff, I think you had a further comment. K2MIT, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, from PET scanning, positron emission tomography, we know that's called the central executive, what you're describing, central executive function, which moves things in and out of working storage and long-term storage. But King Kong on the tower always made me believe it's like birds on a high voltage line. As long as he's not touching the ground and the tower at the same time, if he's grabbing onto the tower and it takes a lightning strike, isn't he like the birds who were just both claws are on the high tension lines and 450,000 volts are going through them and they're just having a happy day, they're not grounded, so nothing happens? Over.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Jeff. As long as you're on a very good conductor, then the voltage drop across the conductor is going to be very small and you're going to experience very little of it. You can find a particular YouTube video, which I believe is not just a hoax, where this guy is doing inspection of 300 kilovolt lines, power lines going across the open field. He's on a helicopter. He's on the skid of a helicopter. The helicopter comes over to the high voltage line. He puts a jumper wire between the helicopter and the wire, and you see some arcing that looks like it's about a foot of arcing. He connects the two. Then when he's got the helicopter grounded to the line, he crawls over to the line and disconnects the jumper wire and proceeds with his walking along that line with a safety harness where he's doing a line inspection. So as long as you're on a highly conductive surface in the right manner and you understand where the currents are flowing and where the fields are flowing, you can get away with murder, so to speak. When a cow in the field, let me drop... A cow in the field is standing on the ground. Let's assume the cow is facing to the north. And let's assume that 30 feet away from him, a lightning bolt to the north takes place. Because the earth is only a partial conductor, now you can get a significant E-field drop across that earth. Therefore, the front legs of the cow are getting one potential, the rear legs of the cow are getting another, and there are examples where the cow becomes electrocuted, not because he was struck with lightning, but because of the potential drop across Earth, a partial conducting surface, with this gradient field taking place, happens. By the same token, if you're in a field and a lightning is coming along, they recommend you put your 2 feet as close together as possible and squat down, and even put 1 foot on top of the other if you can, in order not to experience this particular voltage drop across the earth, because the earth is not that good a conductor. But voltage-wise, I think Bill was quite safe in what happened. Current-wise, and what the magnetic field was doing during that incident is something else. If it was a normal lightning bolt, let me drop. A normal lightning bolt of around 11,000 amperes on a good-sized tower with reasonable cross-section to the steel of the tower, he's reasonably safe. You get one of those positive polarity lightning bolts, which are around 10 times stronger, 100,000 amperes flows, and about 20 or 30, about 2 or 3 or 4 of those individual strikes, only a small fraction of a second apart. Now we're getting an amount of physics that scares me. And as I said before, I'm awful glad he was strapped in with a harness at the time, because other than that, I think gravity could have gotten Bill down, if you know what I mean. We're getting into some fancy subjects here, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Let me go back to Mel first, and then I'll pick up Glenn next. Go ahead, Mel.
Getting late, Dick. Let me get in a couple of these questions, because otherwise we'll never get to it tonight. So we
hold that thought, Glenn.
Later. It's a fascinating subject. So what do you say we get a couple mailbox ones in before we get to 10?
Go for it, Mel.
Hey, Glenn, I apologize. We'll pick you up right after. All right. Here's a question. In my father's truck, they have a Motorola communication system that he uses. I'd like to use the speaker for my VHF, UHF transceiver that's also now in the mobile. The speaker, I understand, says 3 ohms on it, the Motorola speaker. My radio says 8 ohms. What will happen to my radio by connecting it to the speaker? Or what will happen to the speaker? So, okay, good question. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of misbelief on this one. A guy's got a hi-fi rig, and the output of the rig says it's supposed to go to 8-ohm speakers, and he owns either 4-ohm speakers or 16-ohm speakers, and he wants to know, are they going to explode and blow up and burn up, and is the rig going to be unhappy, and so on. Most audio amplifiers with modern-day what's called damping factor, which really means audio feedback, are extremely forgiving. The worst-case situation I know of is if the speaker has an impedance much, much higher than what the amplifier is rated for. That means that now the amplifier trying to deliver a certain amount of current is going to go to a higher voltage, and you could get a flat-topping characteristic at maximum audio amplitude, and you hear a little bit of distortion. The much friendlier direction is that if the amplifier is rated for 8 ohms and your speaker is 4 ohms, the speaker is being loaded a little bit more heavily. That doesn't hurt. And you're going to get a little bit less than normal audio output. But with that volume control, on almost every audio amplifier, you've got a lot more volume than you can choose. And the fact that it gives you 1 dB less audio because of an impedance mismatch is an extremely minor factor. So not to worry. Every time I put the wrong impedance speaker on a particular amplifier, I've never been able to see the difference. So I think it's a very friendly function. I wonder if you've got a similar experience on this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, Motorola. I was worried for that, beauties. I don't want to get into that. Would get questions like that. I remember way back, in fact, I saw it a number of times, and what they used to recommend, I don't know where the heck they came up with that 3-ohm deal to begin with, but they used to recommend that if you're going to use that speaker, that they used to call that speaker called their TSN, Motorola TSN series speakers. They're well made, you know, they were a nice metal box with a sort of like a tilt bracket and everything, and had good quality. Gee, amazing, the quality used to come out of those. That was their, called their land mobile system. And what they used to recommend, that you put a 5-ohm, 5-watt resistor in series with the speaker to whatever other device if you wanted to add, Dick, over.
Comment. Yeah, I think that's overly conservative. Yes, that does force an exact impedance match as far as the amplifier is concerned. If you did a very exacting set of laboratory measurements, and you're using an amplifier that's rated for 4 ohms, and you've got a speaker that's really 2 ohms or 8 ohms, some impedance, apparent impedance mismatch, you did a very careful set of laboratory measurements, assuming the design really was what they say it is, I think your 0.1% total harmonic distortion would go to 0.15. It would take laboratory equipment to see the difference. It's going to be extremely minor. Is that 5-ohm resistor required? I say absolutely not. Nothing bad's going to happen if you don't do it. If they've designed equipment that is so sensitive that it experiences damage because it sees a slightly lower impedance on the audio output, I'll admit when it comes to the RF impedance to an antenna, you make a 2-to-1 impedance change, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on an HF rig, that's fairly serious. Audio is very unforgiving along these lines, is my experience. N2XJN, go ahead with your comment, Wes, K2RAW, the DECnet.
W-A-2-S-A-Y with a comment.
Doug recognized, but you got it first, Wes.
N2XJN, during the years, I was dealing with different kind of devices using the speakers. Sound systems, multi-room sound systems, receivers, and I found one thing that is happening. When you connect a 8-ohm speaker to 4-ohm output, you have a half of the sound. When you do reverse and you have an 8-ohm output and you put 4-ohm speaker, you have a twice of the dBs of the sound. But never happened that I damage anything. And to hear.
And what you're calling half the sound, Wes, is really a perception. If I had a true 8-ohm, a true 4-ohm real output impedance audio amplifier, and I connect it to an 8-ohm speaker, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to get half the power. The way the amplifier usually works, you're going to get more than half. Yes, you can hear a difference, but the difference is not as bad as you think. Let me think about that for a second. If it was an amplifier with an extremely large damping factor, you'd have half the current. You're right. If the amplifier had an extremely high feedback ratio, you would be getting exactly half the power.
What you've got, what you thought that you have more, is the size of the membrane in the speaker. That's what put you around. But when you took a very sensitive dB meters, you're going to have a 50% of the power. And to exist.
Yeah, with a very high damping factor, which really means very high feedback ratio amplifier, I'm going to agree with you. You're going to get half the power in watts to that loudspeaker. And therefore, in theory, you're going to get half the volume measured in the right kind of decibel unit. Doug, I bet you've put various speakers on various amplifiers, audio. I know that you've run a lot of high-power audio amplifiers on your music-generating system, so I bet you've got experience along these lines. W-A-2-S-A-Y, out east, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
Hi, Dave. This is W-A-2-S-A-Y. Hello to the rest of the group, too. The thing that everybody is overlooking here is that the impedance of a loudspeaker is not constant over frequency. It varies dramatically from low to high frequency. I'm looking at a curve right now from Wikipedia, and it varies, they're talking about a 4-ohm speaker, and it varies from like 3.5 ohms to like, over 12 ohms over a normal frequency response. So this is just one particular speaker. So you're really not matching the speaker. You're matching it at some particular frequency, probably about maybe a kilohertz or 500 hertz or something like that. Even if you were matching it, which you're really not, as Dick pointed out, your amplifier impedance is actually much lower than the speaker impedance. You're not matching impedance, throwing away half the power in the amplifier. Your amplifier is really a current generator. WA2SAY, back to that.
I don't understand one thing. One has nothing to do with the other. Whether you have 4 ohms, you have 8 ohms, the characteristic of the frequency is very much similar. We talk about the power of the speakers if we put to the wrong impedance on it, effectively.
Okay, you've expressed an opinion, Wes, and I'm going to be agreeing a little bit more with Doug. Doug, let me ask you this question. Where you saw that curve of change of impedance versus frequency, was the loudspeaker giving you a higher impedance at the low frequencies and a lower impedance at the high frequencies? Or was that approximately what the curve is showing, Doug? SAY, K2LIW.
Dick, WA2SAY, back to you. No, this particular curve shows a peak of about, it looks like about 6.5 ohms at 100 hertz, and about 3.5 ohms at 20 hertz, and it goes up to, 12 ohms or so up at, 20 kilohertz. So it's a double hump. There's a hump around a little over 100 hertz or thereabouts. Matter of fact, it says 102.9 hertz on the chart here. And at that point, it's a 6.37 ohm impedance. And then at, as I say, up at that 10 kilohertz, it's about 9 ohms. And about 20 kilohertz, it's around maybe 12 ohms. So it's like a, it goes up, then it goes down again. It hits another minimum down around, 400 ohms, I guess. 400 hertz, I should say. Around 400 hertz, it hits another minimum around 4 ohms, which is what the curve is designed for. So this particular speaker is 4 ohms around 400 hertz. And it's not 4 ohms. Well, it's also 4 ohms around maybe 35 hertz. So that's it's a funny, it's a curve which is, it's got one peak around 100 hertz, and then it's got a minimum around 400 hertz, and then from there it goes up and up and up and away, up as far as the chart goes, which is 20 kilohertz. WA2SAY, back to that.
Very fine, Doug. So the bottom line of all this is that a microphone or a loudspeaker have impedances that, as a function of frequency, can vary all over the place. I'm going to agree with something else that Doug said, that the actual transistors that are driving the final stage of that audio amplifier are, in general, current-generating devices, and they're trying to issue a constant amount of current. However, the tubby effect you can get out of a loudspeaker if you don't have the right kind of an enclosure and the right kind of an amplifier, the so-called damping factor. Let me explain what I mean by that. Let me drop. It's very easy to take an old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeter and go down to the one-ohm scale, the times-one scale, where the volt-ohm milliammeter, when it's measuring ohms of an external circuit, is putting some significant amount of current, maybe 50 or 100 milliamps, into the unknown. And you put that across the terminals of a loudspeaker, you'll hear a pop as you make contact. And you'll hear sort of an inverse pop as you stop making contact. So you do that with a loudspeaker on the table, and you'll hear some very characteristic sounds. In other words, the loudspeaker itself has got all kinds of acoustic resonant frequencies, both in impedance and the way it acts as far as it launches a audio wave into the air. The purpose of your loudspeaker enclosure is to try to get rid of some of those individual high Q points. If you don't, it's going to have a tubby sound to it. And very similar to what happens with a meter movement. You can take a Dawson-Val meter movement, which is open-circuited, and you shake it back and forth. You can easily make the needle banging up against the two stops. Put a short circuit across the meter on the back two terminals, and you swing it again, and almost no motion of the meter takes place. You are magnetically damping it. As such, hi-fi manufacturers a long time ago realized that if you want the best sound out of a loudspeaker, you make it kind of lossy, you put it in the right kind of an enclosure, and you make the equivalent output impedance real of the audio amplifier approach 0 ohms. Now you're dampening out the natural resonance phenomena. By way of the voltage feedback, and many very high-quality audio amplifiers have a tremendous amount of voltage feedback. Because of the voltage feedback, the amplifier itself becomes nearly a constant voltage-generating circuit, which has an impedance that's very nearly 0 ohms, and therefore it does a lot of acoustic dampening.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Therefore, it does a lot of acoustic dampening of the natural resonant frequencies of the loudspeaker. So When we talk about a 4-ohm output impedance of an amplifier, we're not talking about reality. We're talking about the fact that the design with all of that feedback is such that it gives the designed performance. Your amplifier may be rated for 30 watts of output, and it's going to be rated for a 4-ohm loudspeaker, and the manufacturer, if he's telling you the truth, is saying that he's guaranteeing the power output and the total harmonic distortion across 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, in theory, if you load it in that manner. That's sort of what he's saying. But as you can tell, the real impedance of the amplifier is very different than you think. The real impedance of the loudspeaker is very different than you think. And the enclosure is another big factor. As you can tell, like everything else, there's a lot more variables involved than first meets the eye. I know we went a lot further than we need to, Mel, but I thought it's a fun subject. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so you want to take Motorola's advice. Basically, I fix it. I don't think anything will blow up, explode, or whatever. But if you want to listen to what Motorola says, put a 5-ohm resistor in series and make Papa happy and say that you did exactly what manufacturer suggests. All right, one more, Dick. Shall we give it a try?
Fire away.
Okay, I have a question regarding batteries. Oh boy, with batteries. We had it this morning on the TechNet, on the morning net, 10-meter net. I have 4AA 1.2-volt, 1,600 milliampere-hour nickel-metal hydride batteries. I suspect that one of the batteries is not holding a charge. How do I do it with a simple volt-ohm milliamp meter, which is the only instrument actually that I own, to check to determine if a battery is holding a charge? Good one. I've had this answered. Here's this question answered. I have a feeling nice answer for it, but let's hear what everybody has to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, a so-called battery pack that's made out of 3, 4, 5, 6 cells in series is a very critical thing. In theory, every one of the cells should be equally matched in two ways. They should, three ways. If this is the best of all worlds, they should be matched in their newness. They should be matched in their milliampere hour capability. They should be matched in their level of charge. They should be matched in their internal leakage resistance. If any of those things are unmatched, you're going to be unhappy. If one of the three cells has more internal leakage resistance than another, and you put this fully charged battery pack on the shelf and you leave it there for 2 weeks and pick it up and slam it into your radio, and where one of the three or four cells has been discharging itself because of significant internal resistance, and that cell goes dead before the other three, that's bad. Because now, as you're discharging the whole battery pack, one of those cells that reaches zero charge first is going to experience reverse charge because of the current that's flowing through the whole pack. And that's the reverse current, in many cases, will do damage. So you really want the cells to be matched in every way you can. Level of charge, leakage resistance, ampere hour capacity, and newness. It's very tempting, for instance, to have a bad cell and drop... to have a bad cell in a battery pack and say, well, I'll just replace that one. Well, unless you can put one in there that matches the other three in all of those characteristics, at some period of time, you're going to be in trouble. Now, in order for you to test the whole battery pack, in theory, you start off with the pack fully charged, and the word fully charged got some funny meanings to it. In other words, you charge it for a significant number of minutes and milliamperes so that at least 80% of the charge should be there on all the cells. Then, in theory, you should be putting a trickle charge on there for a long period of time, just in case one of the cells started off discharged for some crazy reason, and you want to bring them all up to the same charge. If one of the cells was almost discharged and the other three are fully charged, and you put it on a normal charger, the one cell that's almost discharged, he's getting full current, and he's happier sooner. But the other three that are fully charged are going to be overcharged, and they're going to be unhappy. So 80% charge and then trickle charge after that is one way of eventually bringing the whole pack up to a full charge. Then in theory, you put the rated load on that battery pack, and you, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to plot the voltage of each individual cell as the whole pack is being discharged. And if you get down to the point where the voltage coming out of the whole pack is the normal cutoff voltage, and if at that particular point of time, all of the cells have the exact same voltage of them at that instant of discharge, you've got a beautifully married, well-married set of cells. Very few of us do all of that. But in theory, you should do all of that if you don't want to run into all kinds of troubles. That's a bunch of opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, that sounds feasible. Well, what I used to do in the past, you know, came up really through the years when we didn't have much in the way of batteries except the carbon, the old carbon zinc battery. That's what a battery was to me, number six dry cell with a battery or D battery, you know. Now, of course, we got a lot of sophisticated batteries around. But if you have a pack, what I would do, and I would charge it up to what it's supposed to really be. You take the VOM, charge the batteries up as they're recommended, and then I take like a 5-ohm, 1-watt resistor, put it across the terminal, and watch the voltage drop across each cell, and see if one cell does not seem to hold it, you know, one dropping off much faster than the others. And I figure that's a quick way to give an idea which cell may be the sick cell. I think the sick one, the bad one, would be sort of a more of a significant drop-off and decrease faster, Dick. And then I got one more question on this. Go ahead.
And to see any other comments?
Yeah, I agree with all of the above. And in the case of nickel-cadmium batteries, whenever a cell became weaker than the rest of the pack, that's the cell that always became reverse discharged. If you deeply discharge the whole battery pack, and that one eventually grows whiskers because of the reverse charge, the whiskers eventually give you a short circuit. And then you can come along with a, let me pick a number, 5,000 microfarad capacitor charged up to 15 volts, put it plus to plus, minus to minus, the battery, the capacitor across that particular cell. You can burn away the whisker, and for a period of time, that cell comes back to life, but there's a catch. And the catch is the cell where you burned away the whisker, you've left a whole lot of detritus inside that cell. It's got a whole lot of extra leakage resistance. You can charge that battery, and if you use it right away, things are medium good. You put that particular battery on the shelf for 24 hours, which is the normal way you use your handy-talkie. You pick it up the next morning, and because that cell with the extra leakage has been discharging itself, that whole battery pack is not going to be so great. So you don't get a great deal of increase in performance when you burn away your whisker. Know that it's a last resort type situation, but it's not a great fix. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN, I have a comment to the subject we just discussed. I connected to Windkeer magnetic, precision magnetic analyzer, connected the speaker, and yes, you were right, I was wrong. At 120 hertz, I have 10 ohms, 10.5 ohms. At 150 hertz, I have 22 ohms. At 1 kilohertz, I have 6 ohms. At 2 kilohertz, I have 6.5 ohm. At 4 kilohertz, I have 7.5 ohm. At 12 kilohertz, I have 12 ohms. And at 20 kilohertz, I have 12 ohms. And to XGM.
As you guys are starting to hear, John and Wesley are building themselves up, if they haven't already done so, some significant laboratories, and you are listening to a live test of a loudspeaker. And so those individual peaks of impedance, which Wesley was experiencing, peaks and valleys, are showing you some of the complex resonance phenomena that almost every loudspeaker has. you can DQ some of those undesirable resonance phenomena. In other words, if your loudspeaker, if this was the best of all worlds and you could buy a really Cadillac loudspeaker, if somebody could build it, you'd like it to have 4 ohms of impedance, for instance, at every frequency from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. Well, that would be an extremely elaborate mechanical design. It probably would be a very expensive thing. So real loudspeakers have all kinds of crazy resonances. By the proper design of a baffling network that's designed for that particular loudspeaker, combined with an amplifier that has a very high damping factor, that really means the amplifier acts like almost a constant voltage generator with nearly zero impedance to give you magnetic damping of the loudspeaker's resonances. Let me drop. You combine those two properly done designs, the proper baffle designed for the characteristics of that speaker, combined with a real good damping factor, high feedback ratio amplifier, you can take what looks like a mediocre performance loudspeaker and you can get some extremely good performance out of it. So good audio output requires the right marriage of amplifier, speaker, and baffle. And if you want to go to the next step, it requires the right kind of acoustics of the room. You put that real high-performance loudspeaker in a very high echo room, a very hard room, and you're going to be unhappy. So proper reproduction of audio requires a lot of thought. I was at a wedding reception yesterday. I was at a wedding yesterday, which was in a particular Catholic church that's in Farmingdale, Long Island, where the floors are marble, the walls are hard substance, the ceiling is a hard substance, a very high echoey room. And so to hear what people are saying over that loudspeaker system is nowhere near as easy as it could be. So hi-fi equipment in the wrong environment can give you performance that you're not so happy with. K2KEY, go ahead with another one if you want to, Mel. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, sounds good. All right, so that's the best way, test the batteries best you can. Well, I got a little question of my own. Maybe some people could help me. Believe it or not, I need maybe some advice because maybe they're more current on certain things than I am right now. I have a situation on Wednesdays that I'm up in the Fort Washington area from approximately 7:30 in the morning until usually quite late in the afternoon. I was taken along. I have time, a lot of time in between certain procedures. And I took along an area where I can sit. It's sort of like a, you could say like a patio area, but completely glass enclosed. It's quite fascinating. You're sitting out, hanging out in the middle of nowhere up kind of high. But very comfortable, sunshine and everything. I enjoy sitting there. And ease the boredom. I read for a while and all, and I have my handy talkie with me and things of that sort. And there isn't, seems like I don't get much in the way of repeat or response, you know, too much, doesn't need to be too much activity. So instead of carrying the handy talkie with me, I have another nice little radio called the Yaesu 8FP817. Let me let it drop and I'll explain it. The 817 is a unique radio, compact radio, 160 through 70 centimeters, AM, CW, sideband, you name it, very compact. The battery, they have a place to put batteries in it. I put in a bunch of alkaline batteries. Didn't last very long. They don't go for very long. I had NiCad batteries. I even tried the battery pack that Yaesu sells with it. Didn't really have much success. It's a situation, of course, I got to carry this on my side, you know, like a handy talkie, basically, with a strap. It's got a strap to, you know, carry it. It's compact. It's reasonable. And I used to use it strictly when I went QRP with an external jail cell, which is not, of course, practical for me to take along. And I have other things I got to take along, so I was wondering, anybody know of any new battery info or something that I, like I said, I'm not that up on a lot of QRPers, you know, info what's doing now. If anybody on frequency maybe can tell me what would you suggest battery-wise, so at least I can not work too much DX, I don't think, up there with much of my Wonder Whip, but at least, you know, get a little operation going. Go ahead, Dick.
I can answer.